This is Talking Asset Management with KPMG, and today's episode is about issues with credit default.
Hello, and thank you for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG and our series on credit funds. I'm Scott Woods, partner and one of our credit fund tax leaders. Today, we're going to talk about issues on credit defaults from multiple perspectives, almost a point-counterpoint format, including what a default means to a creditor and what it means to a debtor. Is the instrument a debt or an equity instrument? And is the loan relating to real estate or more corporate in nature? Joining me today are Pete Ritter and Jim Sewell, principals in our Washington National Tax Practice. This is somewhat of a continuation of our last discussion we had on credit defaults. Last time, we focused primarily on tax issues relating to the creditor or holder. Today, our focus is going to be more on the debtor or borrower. We know many of you are holders of debt, but knowing the tax impacts to the borrowers is very important. One assumption we often make is that a debt instrument is in fact debt for tax purposes. Pete, I know you get the question of debt versus equity often. What can you tell us here and what are you seeing in the marketplace these days?
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Yeah, this is an issue that's coming up frequently these days. And you know, one of the first things we do as tax advisors is determine, you know, what we are dealing with. You know, that is the instrument here, debt or equity? Is it fish or fowl? Sometimes that determination is easy, but that's not always the case. And you know, unfortunately, there are no bright line tests here. And form is certainly not controlling. And instead, what we do is a kind of a facts and circumstances analysis, looking to the overall substance of the arrangement. There is a whole body of case law out there, and the case is set forth, I don't know, I think it's 13 or so different factors that we look to. Too much to cover here, but you know, the bottom line is that in order to have even a chance of being debt, it's thought at a minimum, you got to have a sum certain due that's unconditionally payable at a fixed maturity date with some ability to enforce repayment. So some type of creditor remedies. And of course, good form is helpful, even if it's not controlling. And yes, lately we're seeing folks really test the boundaries here by adding various equity-like features, you know, deeply subordinating the debt in question, and maybe adding, you know, separate warrants and producing some really high interest rates or yields.
And Jim, thanks for joining us today. What are some of the issues a creditor needs to be sensitive to on the debtor side?
Yeah, Scott. So obviously, one of the significant things that the debtor is going to be thinking about is taxes in connection with a distressed situation. In situations involving distress, you're generally looking at two primary scenarios. One is foreclosure, deed in lieu transactions, and the other is modifications of the debt, extend the debt, reduce the debt, change the rates, change the covenants, things like that. And you really look at those two situations differently.
So within each of those two scenarios, what are the significant issues and how might debtors approach the two scenarios differently, depending on their specific facts? Maybe Jim, you could see more in the first scenario of foreclosure and deed in lieu.
Yeah. So in that context, debtors, they're going to focus on a number of things. One will be applicable rates. If I'm an individual, capital gain versus ordinary is going to be important. The availability of exclusions for COD income. There are certain exclusions that are available: bankruptcy, insolvency, qualified real property business indebtedness. And finally, am I going to have a bad character mismatch in connection with the transaction? And in evaluating these, really the first thing that the debtor is going to be concerned with is the nature of the debt. That is it recourse or non-recourse? Because in a foreclosure or deed in lieu situation, you get very different results depending on whether the debt is recourse or non-recourse. If it's non-recourse, the entire debt is treated as amount realized. That can be good for an individual debtor where they are rate sensitive and the underlying assets may produce capital gain or potentially capital loss, depending upon the amount of the debt and the basis of the property. By contrast, if the debt is recourse, the transaction is treated as if the property was sold for its value and the additional debt in excess of the value is ordinary COD income. Ordinary COD income for a individual may be a bad thing because of ordinary income rates. By contrast, if they can qualify for insolvency, bankruptcy, or qualified real property business indebtedness, that could be a good thing. They can exclude the COD income. In addition, this is where you run into potential character mismatches because the underlying asset If it's a capital asset, you've got ordinary income on the COD income, capital loss if the property has significant basis. And that obviously is not a great situation. If the asset is a 1231 asset, depending upon that taxpayer's other 1231 gain or loss, the loss may actually be ordinary, available to offset the COD income, and that may put them in a better place.
Yeah, so it sounds like a lot is hinging on whether or not it's recourse or non-recourse, and a lot of things that you would determine at the time you enter into the instrument.
Yeah, exactly right.
So Pete, tell me a little bit about, you know, workouts, the second category there that Tim mentioned.
Yeah. I know we covered this a bit on a prior podcast, but as part of a workout, the parties are in essence renegotiating loan terms, right? And they're changing maybe the stated interest rate, extending the maturity date, changing the collateral. I guess some cases they might even lower the principal amount due. And the idea here is that if these changes are economically significant, then tax can be triggered, even though no cash technically is being exchanged. And the idea here is that if these modifications are so meaningful, it's as if the old original loan has been swapped for a new modified loan in a deemed taxable exchange. And we have some detailed rules here that tell us how to make this determination. And the terminology used in the tax regulations is that of a significant mod or significant modification. And if you have a significant modification from the debtor's perspective, COD or cancellation of indebtedness issues can arise. And there's a code provision here, section 108E10, that basically says the debtor is treated as having satisfied the old debt here in this deemed exchange for an amount of money equal to the issue price of the new debt. And in most cases where, you know, the principal amount or stated redemption price of maturity has not been reduced as part of the workout activity, you won't have any COD. And that's because the new debt is often not publicly traded, in which case its issue price is essentially just equal to its face or principal amount. So you just have a par for par exchange. But one catch here is that the definition of publicly traded is really broad, and even debt that one might not think of as publicly traded in the traditional sense can be caught here. And if the debt here in fact is publicly traded, now it's fair market value, which might be a lot lower than the original face amount, given some new distress in the system, is the issue price or measuring stick. And now the debtor may be treated as satisfying its old debt at a discount, triggering COD. And again, the regs, tax regulations here make it pretty easy for a debt instrument to be considered publicly traded. For example, even just an indicative quote on Bloomberg can be enough. And I think this is a surprise to many. But for this broad rule to apply, the debt has to be part of an issue of $100 million or more. So this concern really comes up for large debt workouts only.
Back to you, Jim. What are some other factors that could impact a debtor's decision process in working out debt?
First, the tax sensitivities of the debtor. If I've got a super tax exempt, a public pension, something like that, they're simply not subject to tax, even on COD income. So taxes will not generally enter into the picture in their evaluation of a distressed debt situation. Other tax exempts, the exempt nature of COD income is less certain. Many will take the position in a number of contexts that the COD income is not reportable as taxable income for a tax exempt, but that position is, I would say, uncertain at the very least. Other factors are things like the basis of property. You know, if I've got non-recourse debt and the property is being treated as sold for the amount realized equal to the debt and I've got high basis, no real downside there. So taxes may not be as big a factor there. In addition, if I've got carry forwards, net operating loss carry forwards, capital loss carry forwards, losses that have been deferred as a result of the at-risk or passive loss rules, those also may be available to offset the income in a distressed debt situation. So all of those things are important in understanding how a debtor is going to behave in the context of a workout situation.
So sometimes rather than foreclosure, the borrower and lender will negotiate for the borrower to just sell the property and turn over the proceeds to the lender in satisfaction of that debt. Jim, are there issues that must be considered to distinguish that transaction from a foreclosure?
Yes, so it's interesting. There is a case that says if the debtor sells the property essentially on behalf of the lender, that is, they've coordinated with the lender with respect to the terms of the sale, they have to turn over the proceeds to the lender. The case 2925 Briar Park says that you're going to treat that like a foreclosure. But contrast that with a situation where the debt isn't being completely eliminated in the sale transaction, but instead the debtor is going to sell the property, is going to turn over the proceeds, but the lender is also going to continue as a lender on the assets, having modified and reduced the debt. In that transaction, the modification of the debt is treated as occurring in a transaction that's separate from the sale and generally will give rise to COD income. So if you've got non-recourse debt, the parties are expecting amount realized treatment based on the 2925 Briar Park case, but instead there is some amount of debt that carries over with the current lender, you get a very different result, COD income as opposed to amount realized. So really important to recognize the difference of those two transactions and the significance of continuation of lender participation after the sale.
A lot of stuff to consider there. Pete, we're about down to our last minute or so, but I wanted to ask you, how do multiple significant modifications come into play here?
Yeah, great question. There is one nuanced issue here that we've seen lately that I think is worth mentioning. And, earlier we talked about debt versus equity, and I should have clarified that this determination is, made up front only at the time of issuance of the debt. That is, you don't generally retest, debt equity over the life of the instrument. But when you have a workout, which we're talking about now, and a significant mod or significant modification, now there is technically a reissuance of the debt such that you do, in fact, need to retest things here on the debt equity front. And the tax regulations I referenced dealing with significant modifications say that if you modify debt in a way such that the new debt instrument is no longer debt, but equity, then you will have a significant modification and this deemed exchange. So if you start adding equity-like features to the original instrument, subordinate things severely, then you may well have created an equity instrument here. There is a special rule, though, in the tax regulations that basically says that in making this debt versus equity determination with respect to the new modified debt, the deterioration of the debtor's financial condition is not taken into account. And the special rule is intended to be favorable in these workout scenarios. And without it, many workouts would automatically be treated as significant modifications and trigger deemed exchanges. But the rules here is even broader, and it goes to whether the new instrument continues to be debt, even in situations where you might actually have a significant modification. That being said, this special rule I'm talking about here is not perfectly drafted. And under a narrow reading, if a debt instrument is modified more than once, many tax advisors worry that under a literal interpretation, one cannot look back to the creditworthiness of the debtor at the time of the original borrowing. So some say that you only get one bite at the apple here with respect to this rule. And I should also mention the special rule does not apply if you, substitute a new obligor or add or delete a co-obligor.
Wow. So, man, there's tons to consider here. And I certainly do appreciate both you, Jim and Pete, for joining us today and sharing your insights. And thank you, audience, for listening once again. We want to hear from you. So if you have any questions about this topic or anything else, please reach out to Pete, Jim, or any of your KPMG contacts. Thanks again. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series and visit read.kpmg.us/talking-asset-management for more information.